Hello, this is Dr. Rita Marie Moscalzo, and welcome to Understanding Glucose and Insulin. We are here to learn about how to test glucose levels and what that means about your insulin levels and how to interpret the graphs that you get when you do your own testing. So before I begin, I just want to make sure you understand that this presentation isn't intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified doctor, health care practitioner. It's also not intended as medical advice. It's intended as a sharing of my knowledge and information from my research and experience. And I encourage you to consult with your doctor, your practitioner, if you're under the care of one, if you have any diagnosed conditions or you're on any medication before you start to test and before you start to follow some of the dietary or lifestyle changes that may be indicated. So let's start with, people ask all the time, what does normal sugar mean? And when I do this testing, what does it mean when I get these results? So I got this graph. It was taken by a study that was done with normal groups of people. And these people are, and when they say normal, are people that have not been diagnosed with a diabetes of any type or form. You know, of course, they could be borderline insulin resistance or beginning to develop insulin resistance, but they do not show signs of that. You know, they're not overtly diagnosed. So that's what I mean by a normal population. When they tested this group, they basically did a fasting baseline. So from 6 a.m. until 7:30, they had not eaten anything, and they just tested their glucose throughout that period. And you can see the normal variations, you know, range in the 60s, a little bit dipped down, but mostly in the 60s. And at the high end was just below 100 in like the mid to upper 90s. Once they ate, which was marked on the chart at 7:30, they were given a high carbohydrate meal. Generally, that means that there was some refined sugar and flour in that meal. It wasn't a high fiber kind of a meal. This was a high sugar meal. And then they monitored them over time. So what you'll see is 7:30 is when they ate. They all had this kind of very similar rise, peak, and then fall back down to baseline. Every single one, regardless of where they started, they all seemed to peak very close to the same time, which is about 45 minutes after they ate. So the glucose gradually rose, and then it started to fall back again. And at, you know, 3 hours later, which is 10:30, it was back down to normal baseline. And between 3 and then 4 hours later, then went all the way out to 5 hours after the meal, and you can see that it flattens out. So this is considered a normal curve. It never goes below the starting point by any significant amount anyway. It might, you know, vary by a couple of points here and there, but typically it doesn't go much below the starting point, and it doesn't go much above the peak. So where does the peak happen? Well, at the low end of norm, the low end of the curve, the peak happened at, looks like, about 96 or 7. So upper 90s was the highest point the glucose ever got. At the high end, it's a little bit higher, the highest point it ever got was just above 160. On average, people peaked at somewhere a little bit above 120. Okay. So on the bottom curve, what you're seeing is the brown line, this brown kind of goldish one here, insulin, this is the insulin. And so you watch, you know, when at baseline, when folks are just, you know, kind of hanging out, there's very low insulin levels, very low. And then as they have more exposure to the sugars, the insulin levels peak, and then they come back down to the baseline. And it takes them a little while to come on down. Meanwhile, this whole time when your insulin is high, you're exposing your tissues to the insulin levels, and they can become, run the risk of becoming resistant, or in the case of the blood vessels, they become damaged. And I've given you reference, so if you want to read more and look at the study specifically, you can. So I pulled this out of a diabetes journal, and basically it's kind of agreed around that a normal fasting blood sugar, and that's before a meal, or really it's first thing in the morning, but it should return to normal after 3 hours, it looks like, is about 83 or less. So many healthy people have blood sugars that are in the high 70s. So that's the range we're looking for. So people who have their blood sugars up at 95 to 100 and are told that they're normal, this is not normal. There's studies that suggest that this range predicts diabetes that might have been diagnosed a decade later. So if you're running with your sugars at around 100, right, or in the mid-90s, that could be that you're about 10 years away from diabetes, according to the statistics. So what's a normal after-meal blood sugar? Well, the after-meal is often called the post-prandial. And independent of what they eat, the normal blood sugar of a truly normal person is under 120, 1 or 2 hours after a meal. Most normal people are under 100 two hours after eating. So that's why we've been striving for 110, right? When you look back at that other graph had some, the average was a little bit above 120, but that was given a high carbohydrate test meal, something that someone who's striving to be healthy is not going to eat on a regular basis. But where people who are heading towards diabetes or who don't really pay attention to what they eat, that's kind of similar to what they do eat. Now there's a test that's called the glucose tolerance test. And what the glucose tolerance test does is gives you a glucose syrup, basically, and it's 100 grams of glucose in water. And 100 grams of glucose is about 400 calories. So pure 400 calories of pure sugar. That's a lot of sugar. That's a lot of sugar. And then they measure what does your body do over the next 5 hours. So here are the lines. At the very bottom is the normal end of minimum, you know, the minimum end of normal. And basically these people started out, went up a little bit above 100, and then came down. This is on normal, this is just on glucose syrup. This isn't on normal food. The max, people went up a little bit above 150, maybe to 160, and came back down. It's very similar to what we found in the other chart. When they did this with diabetics, the diabetics had different ranges depending on whether they were mild, severe, or combination of hypoglycemia and diabetes. So on this pink line here, if we follow that one, that's somebody who has mild case of diabetes. And notice it's not that much different than the quote-unquote normal people at the max level. The differences are it goes up a little bit higher. It starts out a little bit higher. Fasting blood sugars are high in a diabetic. And then it stays elevated longer before it comes back down. In a severe diabetic, you'll see that they start out with a fasting glucose of very high. And then as soon as they eat this sugar solution, their sugars go way, way, way high. But they're just not, you know, they don't go that much above where they started from. You know, it's 50 points compared to where they go to at about that same time everybody else is peaking. But they continue and continue and continue, and even at 3 hours after, they're peaking and they're way, 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 way high. So these are people who are diabetic. They are not able to handle sugar at all. Then we have the interesting case, which is this number, this red one. Right? And then the red one is someone who has diabetes and hypoglycemia. So their sugars start out a little bit on the high side. They peak over 200. And then they drop down, and they're going down at a similar rate to where everybody else is, right around the two-hour mark. But look what happens if you follow them out. When you get to 3 hours, they're below the baseline of the minimum person, and then when you keep going out, they continue to go down. So this is why it's important when you're testing foods the first time through, if you want to really get a good sense of what they're doing in your body, is that you test all the way out to 5 hours. So this is a normal minimum curve according to Seal Harris, who is one of the very first people to ever talk about insulin resistance in the medical literature, and this was back in the 30s. But this is where he felt, you know, a normal minimum curve, and this is the ideal. This is everything's really in good shape, and you've got good reserves. And so you basically start out at 80, and you peak at 105, and you come back to 80. And that's what we're striving for here. This is the normal maximum curve, according to him. And there, in way back when, I guess they were saying that a fasting blood sugar of 120 was okay, was still within the normal. Now we're saying that it's not, and you know, really 95 is the max, and 100 at the outset is what's accepted as a normal max is considered, a fasting is considered somewhere around 100, and once you get above 110, you're a candidate for possible diabetes intervention. But he's saying that around 120, and they go up to about 160 at peak, and then they're coming down. This is what they're considering a normal curve, but we don't really consider it normal. Also, because they're producing a lot of extra insulin, their baseline comes down below the normal. So it's almost like this person is a little bit insulin resistant and is having a little bit of hypoglycemia type responses, although it's not true hypoglycemia because it doesn't get really low. It's that kind of response. This is someone who is pre-hypoglycemia. So watch what's happening here. Start out at 90, that's good. Jump up to 115 pretty quickly. Go up to 140, which is too high. Come back down to 100 at 2 hours. At 85 at 3, which is close enough to the starting point that I wouldn't be getting upset about it. But then at 4 hours, it goes down to 80, which is 10 points below. 5 hours, it goes down to 70. So it goes down to 20 points below where it started at the fifth and sixth hour. Again, this is why if you do a 3 hour test, you don't really catch it. You may think that a food is okay for you, that you're responding well to it, and it may actually be triggering this response. This is somebody with mild hypoglycemia. So the other was borderline, this is mild. They go from 80 to 120, and very quickly they're starting to come back down. To 80 at 1 hour, 60 at 2 hour, and they jump back up to 80, 75, 80, not 80. So they're really just having a little bit of a dip at 2 hours. And again, if you hadn't, you know, weren't careful in monitoring, you're not going to catch this. So the severe hypoglycemia, look what happens here, 95 up to 110, up to 120, back down to 105, 100, but at 4 hours, they're at 60. At 5 hours, they dip down to 40, and at 6 hours, they're still at 60. This is very severe hypoglycemia, and you're going to feel really, really bad in this range. We talked about now, we get a sense of what glucose curves look like. Unfortunately, we don't have an easy way to test insulin at home the way we do with glucose. However, you know, we normally, if you look at that first chart, we saw that insulin and glucose usually rise at pretty much the same rate, so it's pretty easy to predict if your glucose is going up, your insulin's going up, but not necessarily. There have been a bunch of studies that show that there are some foods that raise insulin without raising your glucose. And remember, when you raise insulin, you're bathing your cells in lots of extra insulin for long periods of time, and they run the risk of becoming insulin resistant and also developing inflammation, and in the case of the vessels, stiffening and hardening of the arteries. So here's some of the things that they found, that some foods don't raise glucose but increase insulin. Dairy products. Dairy products produce high insulin responses, even though they have a low glycemic index, meaning they don't raise the glucose very much. Insulin response to milk isn't just due to the lactose, which is the milk sugar. That's what they originally thought. Well, it contains lactose. But the rise in insulin is disproportionate to the amount of lactose in there. What they found is that there's amino acids, leucine, valine, lysine, and isoleucine, that are insulinogenic, which means that they cause rises in insulin. These amino acids are highest in whey protein, in the whey part of the dairy product. So that's why when people ask me, can I take whey protein during this program, is whey protein a good protein to take? Well, I don't think it's a good thing to take if you're insulin resistant or developing that or looking to prevent that. Well, protein-rich foods and foods rich in fat and refined carbohydrate, they seem to elicit responses that were higher than their glycemic responses. So some of the foods that that did this were like, lentils, which are high in protein and carbohydrate, eggs, and fish, which is high in omega-3 fat. There are some of the unexpected results of this. But when you mixed protein-rich foods with carbohydrate foods, then it elicited insulin responses that were even higher than normal. You see? So it's you're mixing protein-rich foods with carbohydrate-rich meals that can stimulate some insulin secretion without increasing your blood sugar. So it's kind of interesting how all this works. So here's a chart. It's in your documents, but this chart basically is the results of this study. So it shows there's a lot of mumbo jumbo and scientific stuff. If you get overwhelmed with that, just bear with me. Don't look at it. But the bottom line is, when you look at these foods, you look at their glucose score and their insulin score, and things like white bread is considered 100%. So everything else is compared to white bread. So you'll see that in the carbohydrate foods, it's pretty much proportional. The insulin score is just a little bit below the glucose score in all of this. So that's what you would expect. And the same thing is true in your carbohydrate-rich foods. They did breakfast cereals and just breads and grains. Okay, they're the same thing. They're very, very similar. But if you look at things like the protein-rich foods, there's some of them that have a fairly significant insulin score, even though they don't have a high glucose score. Well, that's not here. Like fish has a very low glucose score of 28, but had a high insulin score of 59. Here's a chart that I put together from the information, and there's basically, you'll have a copy of this, the full version of it. So we're basically looking at 240 calorie portions of these foods. In some of these cases, we know what the size of those portions are. Others, we'd have to calculate it. But there's 240 calories per portion. And here's the amount of carbohydrate in there. And when you look, like a 36 in the carbohydrate, you would expect that with oatmeal. Its glycemic index is 60, but its insulin index is only 40, and that turns out that oatmeal actually has some components in it that help with your insulin sensitivity. All bran has a little bit of that as well. The muesli has that as well. So some of these foods actually cause a little bit less insulin because they have some issue things that help with the insulin response. But most of them are pretty predictable. And it's not just related to the amount of carbohydrate, although, it's pretty predictable in these particular foods. So what's the effect of fat and protein on your glucose and insulin? Well, it's, as we said before, milk proteins cause your insulin to rise, and the whey fraction contains the most insulin-secreting chemicals. So it's a good idea to stay off of the milk and stay off of whey. Protein-rich foods, when added to a carbohydrate-rich meal, stimulate insulin secretion without increasing blood sugar. So a lot of times people will say, well, I can eat my bread. It doesn't raise my glucose and it doesn't cause me to feel weird if I eat it with protein or if I eat it with fat. Some people have found that if they take a smoothie and it has a bunch of fruit in it, it rises their sugar. If they add fat to it, then they don't have the same response. Their sugars don't go up as high. However, their insulins might be going up. It's likely that they are going up. until you, you know, reset this whole system and get things working properly again. So the bottom line is that we want to stay away from things that cause excess insulin. And usually we could detect that by looking at our sugar charts, but not necessarily. So in addition to avoiding things that obviously cause your insulin curve to go wacky, it's a good idea to avoid milk and whey proteins. And then avoid having carbohydrate-rich meals with concentrated protein sources. So for example, having fruit and nuts, or fruit and beans, or fruit and meat, or, you know, baked goods and all that as well, are not good combinations. So it's a good idea to avoid milk and whey protein to avoid this insulin-stimulating effect, but also avoid the protein-rich foods mixed with carbohydrate-rich meals, because they can stimulate the secretion of insulin and you wouldn't even know it because your blood sugar isn't going up. And so some combinations that culprit might be like, say, fruit with a piece of steak, or fruit with beans or tofu or something along those lines, or even with nuts. Fruit and nuts is a hard combination and they trigger some responses, because for two reasons with the nuts, it's a little bit high in protein compared to green vegetables, of course, but it's also high in fat. So a large amount of fat added to a carbohydrate-rich meal increases the insulin secretion, even though glucose is reduced. So this is kind of a catch-22. So if you eat, you know, one of these, you know, fancy raw foods bars that's loaded with fruits and nuts, or you throw avocado in a tropical fruit smoothie, it could be creating high insulin levels for you. So when you put too much insulin, when you induce high insulin in people experimentally over 48 to 72 hours, it could create insulin resistance even in healthy subjects. So that's kind of interesting. It's only 48 to 72 hours that you may be starting to stimulate a high insulin response and insulin resistance. Whew. So in there down below are the studies where this came from, and there's links so you can look them up. But basically the conclusion is that since food proteins differ in their capacity to stimulate insulin release, and possibly by affecting the early release of specific hormones, these incretin hormones and insulinotrophic amino acids, this may be the mechanism by which they're working. But milk proteins cause insulin to go high. The whey protein contains the most effect. So we've been checking our fasting glucose and also our postprandial or after meal glucoses, and hopefully after exercise as well. There are a few other tests that you can do to determine, you know, what your risks are for insulin resistance, and whether it's, you know, a transient thing that you're experiencing, or if you have more of the makeup for it. So basically, you know, fasting glucose, ideal 80 to 95. It might even be more ideal 75 to 90 is what more of the latest research is saying. Triglycerides, you want to keep them in the range of 50 to 100. I like to keep them, you know, around 75. is a good level for it. HDL, which is your high density lipoprotein, you know, those can kind of get as high as you need them to get, but if they get too low, that's a surefire sign of insulin resistance. So your ideal insulin levels are between 2 and 5, and your cholesterol is under 100. But over 100 is what you'd expect in insulin resistance. So the other thing that I recommend you doing, if you've been doing your fasting glucoses and your food glucoses and you've been finding any abnormalities, you may want to get a test called hemoglobin A1C and see where that is. That will give you kind of an average of what your glucose has been ranging over the last 3 months. And what that average does is give you a good sense of how your glucose control has been and if you need to tighten it up. So it's a little test. You can do it at home. It's a little bit more challenging and more expensive than the glucose test. So you have to get this little unit and you stick these little cartridges in it and it costs about $17 per test, unless you buy 10 of them at a time, in which case it goes down. You can get them on Amazon. But it's a good idea to test. It's probably, you know, need to test it more than, you certainly could test it once a month initially, just to see if your dietary changes are working. But once they kick in, you should not have to be changing it on a regular basis. Or testing it on a regular basis. So it's a good test to do. It tests for glycosylated hemoglobin, which is basically hemoglobin is the oxygen supplying cells in your blood, and when they get exposed to too much insulin and sugars, they tend to stiffen and they get what's called glycosylated. So your circulating blood cells get stiffened and hardened and filled with sugar, basically. Everything is bad. Well, let's start with what is a normal A1C. And a normal A1C is usually between 4.6 and 5.1%. Further down on here, it tells you how to calculate. An A1C of 5.1 is an average of 100 milligrams that you're maintaining. And if you're maintaining an average of 100, that means that you're having some higher spikes than that. That's about as high as you really want to go. If you're eating all day long, then you're probably, you know, bumping this up in increments. So heart attack risk is in a straight line fashion. As soon as A1C starts to rise above 4.6, you start to increase your risks of heart disease. So really is a good idea to keep your A1Cs to 4.6 or below. Bottom line, you've got a normal glucose curve. You've got this normal glucose curve. You want to strive to be at the low end. You want to strive to have your peak be no more than 110 during this program, but ideally no more than 100. No more than 100 to keep the exposures you have in your blood vessels to be normal. So study these charts, compare these charts to your own, and this should make a whole bunch more sense. So this is Dr. Rita Marie, and thank you.